Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Come, little children, I'll take thee away into a land of enchantment. Come, little children, the time's come to play.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bareback Facts. And contrary to the music you may have just heard, I have no intention of taking any of you to a land of enchantment. On the contrary, I have every intention of taking you straight to hell, right with me. Today, we're going to be talking about the Son of Sam killer, otherwise known as David Berkowitz. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with this very disturbed individual, he earned a great deal of infamy for his crimes during the 70s in New York City, and we'll be getting to that quite soon. As always, I'd like to welcome you all to the show. And before we begin, don't forget our call-in number is 718-508-9883. If you want to call in and talk to me or have questions or have remarks or have something you'd like to contribute to the conversation, I am here listening. If you'd like to call in and complain, I am also here listening. And if you would like to call in and embarrass yourself on the radio, you can join me and do exactly what I'm doing right now. Let's get started. Now, the Son of Sam killer, otherwise known as the 44 caliber killer, but a man we refer to as David, this is a man who was born in Brooklyn, New York, to Betty Broder and Joseph Kleinman. Broder was married to Tony Falco and had a daughter with him, although Falco had abandoned her. They never divorced. She later had an affair with a married man by the last name of Kleinman. When Broder told Kleinman that she was pregnant, he told her to get rid of the baby. However, Broder had the baby and listed Falco as the father. A few days after his birth, the baby was adopted by Nathan and Pearl Berkowitz, a Jewish couple who reversed the order of the baby's first and middle names. John Vincent Sanders writes that David's childhood was somewhat troubled. Although above average intelligence, he lost interest in learning at a very early age and began an infatuation with petty larceny and pyromania. He was an avid baseball player and had earned a reputation as something of a bully in his neighborhood. So as we can see early on, Mr. Berkowitz grew from a very disturbing situation, unwanted by his father and mother, cast aside and adopted into a family strange to him. He grew up troubled. Neighbors and relatives would recall that Berkowitz was difficult, spoiled, and many claimed that he was an avid bully. His adopted parents consulted at least one psychotherapist due to his misconduct, but his misbehavior never resulted in legal intervention or serious mention in his school records. Berkowitz's adoptive mother died of breast cancer when he was 14 years old, and if I didn't mention it, I will re-mention it. He was born on June 1st, 1953, and his mother, of course, died in 1967. Sorry if we missed that. I wanted to make sure that you guys got that. Now, following the death of his mother, his home life became strained during later years, particularly because he disliked his adoptive father's second wife. So as we can see, Mr. Berkowitz was not what we would call a lucky young man by any stretch of the imagination either. Now, at the age of 18, in 1971, he would join the U.S. Army and serve in the United States and South Korea. After an honorable discharge in 1974, he located his birth mother, Betty. After a few visits, she disclosed the details of his illegitimate birth. The news greatly disturbed Berkowitz, and he was particularly distraught by the array of reluctant father figures in his life. A forensic anthropologist named Elliot Layton described Berkowitz's discovery of his adoption and illegitimate birth as the primary crisis of his life, a revelation that shattered his sense of identity, so to speak. His communication with his birth mother later lapsed, but for a time, he remained in communication with his half-sister, Rosalyn. He subsequently had several non-professional jobs, and at the time of his arrest later on, which we will get to, he was working as a letter sorter for the United States Postal Service. Now, in addition to these jobs, important to note that Berkowitz toyed with Christianity, and this is what had ultimately prompted his foray into looking into his past and attempting to locate his birth mother. He wanted to get closer to her. This new spark of religion had led him to seek closure. But unfortunately, all it did was open the doors to a darker past, one that he didn't realize he even had. Now, following, began to isolate himself from not only his birth mother, but his father, his adoptive father, and his siblings. Now, it was during the mid-1970s that Berkowitz had started to commit violent crimes. He bungled a first attempt of murder using a knife, and then switched to a handgun and began a lengthy crime spree throughout the New York boroughs of the Bronx, Queens, and Brooklyn. He sought young female victims specifically and was purportedly most attracted to women with long, dark, wavy hair. On all but one of his crimes, sites included famously committed some of his attacks while the woman sat with boyfriends in parked cars and exhibited an enduring enjoyment of his activities, often returning to the scene of his crimes to revel his achievements. Now, it should come as no surprise that a man with such character would be quite open after being arrested. Berkowitz himself claimed that his first attacks on women occurred in late 1975. When he said two women with a knife on Christmas Eve, one alleged victim was never identified, but Charles Montaldo wrote that the other victim, Michelle Foreman, was hospitalized due to her wounds, and Berkowitz was never charged with committing either crime. Not long afterwards, Berkowitz moved to a home in Yonkers. Now, before we plunge headlong, I want to delve a little bit deeper into Berkowitz after his return from service in the military. To give you an idea of the sort of man that he was. Now, upon his return to New York City, Berkowitz attempted to try his hand at several odd jobs here and there, anywhere he could find work. Despite his above-average intelligence, he had never really focused in school, never pinned down any real passion for any trade. He had gone to the military to sort of find himself and ended up finding that he knew even less of himself than he thought that he did. Things that he did find out upon his return, as I mentioned prior, upset him so that he found himself even more lost than he was when he started his journey. And so, he sort of aimlessly wandered until he ended up settling into a quiet apartment in Yonkers, working as a letter sorter for the U.S. Postal Service, incidentally becoming the impetus for all of the wisecrackers out there who like to use the term going postal. Now, Gawitz was not a bully, not a braggart or spoiled individual by any stretch of the imagination. Rather, his neighbors and co-workers thought of him to be a quiet loner, and none of them had suspected at any time that he could harbor such lethality behind such a quiet, calm exterior. Proving to us all that oftentimes the most deadly predators are those that hide in plain sight. Now, following the Michelle Foreman stabbing, he began his spree in 1976. The first shooting attributed to the Son of Sam occurred in the Pelham Bay area of the Bronx. At about 10 after 1 a.m. on July 29, 1976, Donna Loria, age 18, and her friend Jody Valenti, age 19, were sitting in Valenti's Oldsmobile discussing their evening at Peachtree's, a New Rochelle discotheque. Loria opened the car door to leave and noticed a man quickly approaching the car. Startled and angered by the man's sudden appearance, she said, "Now, what is this?" Her bag that he carried and crouched down. He braced one elbow on his knee, aimed his weapon with both hands, and opened fire. Loria was struck by one bullet that killed her instantly. Valenti, however, was shot in the thigh, and a third bullet missed both women. The shooter turned and walked away without saying a single word. Valenti would survive her injuries and said that she did not recognize the killer. She described him as a white male in his 30s with a fair complexion, about 5 feet 9 inches in height and weighing approximately 160 pounds. His hair was short, dark, and curly in a mod style. The description was repeated by Loria's father, who claimed to have seen a similar man sitting in a yellow compact car parked nearby. Neighbors gave corroborating reports to police that an unfamiliar yellow compact car had in fact been cruising the area hours before the shooting. This was to be the beginning of David Berkowitz's reign of terror across the city of New York. With his trusty .44 caliber Bulldog revolver, he was about to make for a very busy year for local law enforcement. But before we delve too deeply into that, it behooves me to give you all a little bit of a reprieve. So, as is my custom, it is my duty, my obligation, and my distinct pleasure to announce to you all that we do have a proud new sponsor with Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisFreelyPresents.com. And when we come back, we'll delve deeper into the start of one of the most brutal crime sprees in American criminal history. Enjoy the commercial break. I shall be with you quite soon.
I'm black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the Blackmobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your cool friend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the commercial break, and I hope all those things inspired you and gave you some good cheer. Because all the good cheer is about to go away. Now, before I left you for the commercial break, we were talking about the beginning of David Berkowitz's foray into murder. His crime spree began officially in 1976 on a nice July night. He would follow this up in 1976, a similar shooting occurred in a secluded residential area of Flushing, Queens, next to Bound Park. Carl De Niro, age 20, and Rosemary Keenan, age 18, were sitting in Keenan's parked car when the windows suddenly shattered. De Niro said that he felt the car exploded. Keenan quickly started the car and sped away for help. The panicked couple did not realize that someone had been shooting at them. Even though De Niro was bleeding from a bullet wound to his head, Keenan had only superficial injuries from the broken glass, but Anaro eventually needed a metal plate to replace a portion of his skull. Unfortunately, neither victim saw their attacker. Police determined that the bullets embedded in Keenan's car were .44 caliber, but they were so damaged and deformed that they thought it unlikely that they could ever be linked to a particular weapon. Anaro had shoulder-length hair, and police later speculated that the shooter had mistaken him for a woman. Keenan's father was a 20-year-old veteran police detective of the NYPD, causing an intense investigation. As with the Loria Valenti shooting, however, there seemed not to be any motive for the shooting, and police made little progress with their case. Many details of the De Niro-Keenan shooting were very similar to the Loria Valenti case, but police did not initially associate the two together. Part of the shootings occurred in different boroughs and were investigated by different local precincts. On November 27th of 1976, one Donna DeMacy, age 16, and Joanne Lomino, age 18, walked home from a movie soon after midnight. They were chatting on the porch of Lomino's home in Bellarose, Queens, when a man dressed in military fatigues, who seemed to be in his early 20s, approached them and began to ask for directions. In a high-pitched voice, he said, "Couldn't you tell me how to get to," but then proceeded to quickly produce a revolver. He shot each of the victims once, and as they fell to the ground injured, he fired several more times, striking the apartment building before running away. A neighbor heard the gunshots and immediately rushed out of the apartment building and saw a blonde man rush by, gripping a pistol in his left hand. Damazi had been shot in the neck, but the wound was not life-threatening. Amina was hit in the back and hospitalized in serious condition. She was ultimately rendered a paraplegic. Now, during the early morning of January 30th, 1977, Chris Floyd, age 26, and her fiancé, John Deal, age 30, were sitting in Deal's car near the Forest Hills LIRR station in Queens, preparing to drive to a dance hall after having seen the movie Rocky. Three gunshots penetrated the car at 12:40 a.m. In a panic, Deal drove away for help. He suffered minor superficial injuries, but Freund was shot twice and died several hours later at the hospital. Neither of the victims had seen their attacker or attackers. Police made the first public acknowledgement that Freund and Deal's shooting was similar to the earlier incidents, and that the crimes might in fact be associated. All the victims had been struck with .44 caliber bullets, and the shooting seemed to target young women with long, dark hair. Now, NYPD Sergeant Richard Conlon stated that the police were leaning towards a connection in all these cases. Composite sketches were released of the black-haired Laurie Valenti shooter and the blonde Lomino Damazi shooter. Conlon noted that police were looking for multiple suspects, not just one. At about 7:30 on March 8, 77, this terror continued. At Columbia University, a student, Virginia Boskichian, age 19, was walking home from school when she was confronted by an armed man. She lived about a block from where Christine Freund was shot. In a desperate move to defend herself, Boskichian lifted her notebook between herself and the killer, but the makeshift shield was penetrated, the bullet striking her head, killing her. Moments after the shooting, a neighborhood resident who had heard the shots ran around the corner onto her street. He nearly collided with a person whom he described as a short, husky boy, 16 to 18 years of age, clean-shaven, wearing a sweater and a watch cap, who was sprinting away from the crime scene. The neighbor said that the youth pulled the cap over his face and said, "Oh, Jesus," as he sprinted by. Other neighbors claimed to have seen the teenager, as well as another person matching Berkowitz's description, loitering separately in the area for about an hour before the shooting. Following days, the media reported and repeated police claims that this chubby teenager was the suspect. There were no direct witnesses to young Virginia's murder. On March 10th, 1977, a press conference was held by NYPD officials and New York City Mayor Abraham Beame, declaring that the same .44 Bulldog revolver had fired the shots that killed Loria and Boskichian. Official documents were later revealed, however, saying that police strongly suspected that the same .44 Bulldog had been used in the shootings, but that the evidence was still inconclusive due to the condition of the shells. The crimes were discussed by the local media virtually every day. Circulation increased dramatically for the New York Post and Daily News newspapers, with graphic crime reporting and commentary. Foreign media featured many of the reports as well, including front-page articles of newspapers such as the Vatican's Observatore Romano and the Hebrew paper Maariv, as well as the Soviet Izvestia. Quite quickly, these murders became an international sensation. The crimes did not stop there. At about 3 in the morning on April 17, 1977, young Alexander Issao, age 20, and Valentina Suriani, scene, we're sitting in Suriani's car near her home in the Bronx, only a few blocks from the scene of the Laurie Valenti shooting, when each was shot twice. Suriani died at the scene, and Esau died in the hospital several hours later without being able to describe his attackers. Police said the weapon used for the crime was the same as the one which they had suspected in the earlier shootings. During the days afterwards, they repeated their theory that one man was responsible for the 44 murders. A chubby teenager in the Boscovichian case was still regarded as a witness, while the dark-haired man who shot Laurie and Valenti was considered to be the suspect. But this was not the only thing that was peculiar about these crimes. Discovered a handwritten letter near the bodies of Esau and Suriani, written mostly in block capitals with a few lowercase letters and addressed directly to NYPD Captain Joseph Forelli. With this letter, Berkowitz revealed the name Son of Sam for the very first time, and the press, who had previously dubbed the killer the 44 caliber killer because of his weapon of choice, picked it up and ran with it. The letter was initially withheld from the public, but some of its contents were later revealed to the police, and the Son of Sam quickly replaced the old name. The letter expressed the killer's determination to continue his work and taunted police for their fruitless efforts to capture him. In full, with misspellings intact, the letter itself read, I am deeply hurt by your calling me a woman hater. I am not. But I am a monster. I am the Son of Sam. I am a little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up to the back of the house. Other times he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill, commands Father Sam. Behind our house, some rest. Mostly young, raped and slaughtered, their blood drained, just bones now. Papa Sam keeps me locked in the attic, too. I can't get out, but I look out the attic window and watch the world go by. I feel like an outsider. I am on a different wavelength than everyone else, programmed to kill. However, to stop me, you must kill me. Attention, all police. Shoot me first. Shoot to kill. Or else. Keep out of my way or you will die. Papa Sam is old now. He needs some blood to preserve his youth. He has had too many heart attacks. Too many heart attacks. Oh, me. Foot hurts, sonny boy. I miss my pretty princess most of all. She's resting in Our Lady's house, but I'll see her soon. I am the monster, Beelzebub, the chubby behemoth. I love to hunt. Prowling the streets looking for fair game, tasty meat. The women of Queens are the prettiest of all. I must be the water they drink. I live for the hunt, my life. Blood for Papa. Mr. Borelli, sir, I don't want to kill any more. No, sir, no more, but I must honor thy father. I want to make love to the world. I love people. I don't belong on earth. Return me to Yahoo's. The people of Queens, I love you, and I want to wish all of you a happy Easter. May God bless you in this life and in the next. And for now, I say goodbye and goodnight. Police, let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back. I'll be back. To be interpreted as bang, 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 bang. Yours in murder, Mr. Monster. Now, I realize that this might be disturbing for some of you, but this is the first piece of evidence that, besides the 44 caliber shells and slugs, that the police had to work with. Now, at the time, the police, the letter might be familiar with Scottish English. The phrase, me hoot, it hurts, sonny boy, was taken as a Scottish-accented version of my heart, it hurts, sonny boy. And the police also hypothesized that the shooter blamed a dark-haired nurse for his father's death due to the too-many-heart-attacks phrase and the facts that Loria was a medical technician and Valenti was studying to be a nurse. On July 28th, New York Daily News columnist Jimmy Breslin alluded to the Weeman quirk and referred to the shooter watching the world from his attic window. The killer's unusual attitude towards the police and the media received widespread scrutiny, and psychologists observed that many serial killers gain gratification by eluding pursuers and observers. The feeling of control of media, law enforcement, and even entire populations provides a source of social power for them. After consulting with several psychiatrists, police released a psychological profile of their subject and suspect on May 26th of 1977. He was described as a neurotic and probably suffering from paranoid schizophrenia and believed himself to be a victim of demonic possession. On May 30th of 1977, Daily News columnist Jimmy Breslin received a handwritten letter from someone who claimed to be the .44 caliber shooter. The letter was postmarked early that same day in Englewood, New Jersey. On the reverse of the envelope, neatly handprinted in four precisely centered lines, were the words, "Blood and family, darkness and death, absolute depravity," signed. The letter inside read, "Hello from the gutters of NYC, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Hello from the sewers of NYC, which swallow up these delicacies when they are washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalk of NYC, and from the ants that dwell in these cracks and feed in the dried blood of the dead that is settled into the cracks. JB, I'm just dropping you a line to let you know that I appreciate your interest in those recent and horrendous .44 caliber killings. I also want to tell you that I read your column daily, and I find it quite informative. Tell me, Jim, what will you have for July 29th. You can forget about me if you like, because I don't care for publicity. However, you must not forget Donna Loria, and you cannot let the people forget her either. She was a very, very sweet girl, but Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood. Mr. Breslin, sir, don't think that because you haven't heard from me for a while that I went to sleep. No, rather, I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now the void has been filled. Perhaps we shall meet face to face someday, or perhaps I will be blown away by the cops with smoking 38s. Whatever, if I shall be fortunate enough to meet you, I will tell you all about Sam if you like, and I will introduce you to him. His name is Sam the Terrible. Not knowing what the future holds, I shall say farewell, and I will see you at the next job. Or should I say, you will see my handiwork at the next job. Remember, Miss Loria. Thank you. In their blood and from the gutter, Sam's creation, caliber. Here are some names to help you along. Forward them to the inspector for use by NCIC. The Duke of Death, the Wicked King Wicker, the 22 Disciples of Hell, John Wheaties, rapist and suffocator of young girls, P.S. Inform all the detectives working the slaying to remain, P.S. J.B., please inform all the detectives working the case that I wish them the best of luck. Keep them digging. Drive them. Think positive. Get off your butts. Knock on coffins, etc. Upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working the case a new pair of shoes if I can get up the money. Signed, Son of Sam. Now underneath, the Son of Sam was a logo or sketch that combined several symbols. Question from the writer, what will you have for July 29th, was considered an ominous threat. July 29th would, of course, be the anniversary of the first 44 shoot. Crudely written first letter, and police suspected that it might have been created in an art studio or similar professional location by someone with expertise in printing. They even asked members of DC Comics whether they recognized the lettering. The King Wicker reference caused police to arrange a private screening of The Wicker Man, a 1973 horror movie. The New York Daily News published the letter a week later after agreeing with police to withhold portions of the text, and Breslin urged the killer to surrender himself. The dramatic article made that day's paper the highest-selling edition of the Daily News to date. More than 1.1 million copies were sold. Police received thousands of tips based on references in the publicized portions of the letter, all of which proved, unfortunately, useless. All the shooting victims to date had long black hair, and thousands of women in New York acquired shortcuts or brightly dyed their hair, and beauty supply stores had trouble meeting the demand for wigs. On June 26, 1977, there was another shooting. Cal Lupo, age 20, and Judy Placido, age 17, had left the Elephas discotheque in Bayside, Queens, and were sitting in Lupo's car at about 3 a.m. when three gunshots blasted through the vehicle. Lupo was wounded in the right forearm, while Placido was shot in the right temple, shoulder, and back of the neck. Both victims would survive their injuries. Lupo told police that the young couple had been discussing the Son of Sam case only moments before the shooting. Neither of the two had seen their attacker, but the two witnesses reported a tall, dark-haired man in a leisure suit fleeing from the area. One claimed to have seen him leave in a car and even supplied a partial license plate number. Another report described a blonde man with a mustache who drove from the scene in a Chevy Nova without turning on its headlights. Police speculated that the dark-haired man was the shooter and the blonde man had observed the crime. The first anniversary of the initial .44 caliber shootings was approaching, and police established a sizable dragnet that emphasized past hunting grounds in Queens and the Bronx. However, the next and final .44 caliber shootings would occur in Brooklyn. Early on July 31st, 1977, Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante, both age 20, were in Violante's car, which was parked under a streetlight near a city park in the neighborhood of Bath Beach. They had been kissing and making out when a man approached within 3 feet of the passenger side of Violante's car and fired four rounds into the car, striking both victims in the head before he escaped into the park. Moskowitz died several hours later in the hospital, while Violante survived, although he lost vision in one eye and retained very limited vision in his other eye. The Moskowitz-Violante crime produced more witnesses than any of the other Son of Sam murders. There was one direct eyewitness who was not an intended victim. During the shooting, 19-year-old Tommy Zino was parked with his date three cars in front of Violante's vehicle. Moments before the shooting, Zino had caught a peripheral glimpse of the shooter's approach and happened to glance in his rearview mirror just in time to see the actual shooting. He clearly saw the perpetrator for several seconds due to the bright street light and the full moon, later described him as being 25 to 30 years old, of average height, 5'7" to 5'9", with shaggy hair that was dark blonde or light brown. Zino said that the shooter's hair looked like a wig. About a minute after the shooting, a woman seated next to her boyfriend in his car on the other side of the city park saw a white male who was wearing a light-colored cheap nylon wig sprint from the park and enter a small, light-colored auto, which drove away quickly. Other witnesses included a woman who saw a light car speed away from the park about 20 seconds after the gunshots, and at least two witnesses who described a yellow Volkswagen driving quickly from the neighborhood with its headlights off. A neighborhood resident given the pseudonym Mary Lyons heard the gunshots and Violante's calls for help and glanced from an apartment window to see a man whom she later positively identified as David Berkowitz, who was walking casually away from the crime scene as many others were rushing towards the scene to render aid. Now, soon after 2:35 a.m., a man who was later given the pseudonym Alan Masters was driving through an intersection about a few blocks away from the park. Masters was nearly struck by what he described as a yellow Volkswagen Beetle that had sped through the intersection without its headlights activated. As the driver ignored a red light, angered and alarmed, Masters followed the Volkswagen at a high speed for several minutes before losing sight of the vehicle. He described the driver as a white male in his late 20s or early 30s with a narrow face, dark, long, stringy hair, several days of growth of dark whiskers on his face, wearing a blue jacket. Masters was upset, and he neglected to note the Volkswagen's license plate number, but he thought that it might have been a New Jersey rather than a New York plate. Violante had encountered a very similar man, because he and Moskowitz were in a car shortly before they were shot, in the park shortly before they were shot. Valanche described him as a grubby-looking hippie with whiskers, with wiry hair over his forehead, dark eyes, and wearing a denim jacket. Now, police did not learn of the Moskowitz-Violante shooting until about 2:50 a.m., and they did not think that it was another Son of Sam shooting until an officer at the scene reported that large caliber shells had in fact been used. Police established a series of roadblocks about an hour after the shooting, stopping hundreds of cars to question drivers and inspect vehicles. During interviews, Masters and others described the Volkswagen speeding from the scene, and police now suspected the shooter owned or drove such a vehicle. In subsequent days, police determined that there were more than 900 Volkswagens in New York or New Jersey, and they made plans to trace each of these cars and their owners. Detective John Falotico was awakened at home and told to report to the 10th Homicide Division at the 60th Precinct Station House in Coney Island. He was told that Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante had been shot, and was given 2 weeks to work on the case as a normal murder investigation. It was then given to a special Son of Sam task force. Now, before we get to the fate of Mr. David Berkowitz and the end of this crazy spree of the Son of Sam killer, commercial break. And as always, it behooves me to remind you all that we do have a proud new sponsor at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's wacky, he's funny, he's crazy. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
I'm Black Man. Baby Man dies. One stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes' native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause. www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your cool friend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures,
trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bareback Facts, where we are talking about the Son of Sam Killer again. And everybody remember that our call-in number is 718-508-9883. And if you'd like to talk to me, I'm always open to a good conversation. Before we went to the commercial break, we were talking about brutality of the Son of Sam Killer and his demented letters to the police, his taunting letters to media and police, and his attempts to revel in his handiwork. For the commercial break, crimes had reached a head. We pick up here. Local resident Cecilia Davis was walking her dog at the scene of the Moskowitz and Violante shooting when she saw patrol officer Michael Cantaneo picketing a car that was parked near a fire hydrant. Moments after the traffic police had left, a young man, walked past her area from the area of the car, and he seemed to study her with great interest. Davis felt concerned because he was wielding in his hand some kind of a dark-colored object. She ran to her home only to hear shots fired from behind her. Davis remained silent about this experience for 4 days until she finally contacted police, who closely checked every car that had been ticketed in the area that night. Turns out Berkowitz's 1974-door yellow Ford Galaxy was among the cars that they investigated. Despite their claims to the contrary, police initially considered Berkowitz a possible witness rather than a suspect. On August 9, 1977, NYPD Detective James Justice telephoned Yonkers Police to ask them to schedule an interview with Berkowitz. The Yonkers Police dispatcher who first took Justice's call was Wheat Carr, the daughter of Sam Carr and sister of Berkowitz's alleged Colt Confederates John and Michael Carr. Justice asked the Yonkers police for some help tracking down Berkowitz. According to Mike Novotny, a sergeant at the Yonkers Police Department, the Yonkers PD had their own suspicions about Berkowitz in connection with other strange crimes in Yonkers, crimes that they saw referred to in one of the Son of Sam letters. To the shock of the NYPD, they told the New York detective that Berkowitz might just be the Son of Sam. The next day, on August 10, 1977, police investigated Berkowitz's car that was parked on the street outside his apartment building at 35 Pine Street in Yonkers. They saw a rifle in the back seat and searched the car and found a duffel bag filled with ammunition, maps of the crime scenes, and a threatening letter addressed to Inspector Timothy Dowd of the Omega Task Force. Police decided to wait for Berkowitz to leave the apartment rather than risk a violent encounter in the building's narrow hallway. They also waited to obtain a search warrant for the apartment, worried that their search might be challenged in court. The initial search of the vehicle was based on a rifle that was visible in the back seat, although possession of such a rifle was legal in New York State and required no special permits. The warrant still had not arrived when Berkowitz exited the apartment building at approximately 10 p.m. and entered his car. Detective John followed the driver's side of the car and pointed his gun inches from the temple of the person of interest, while Detective Sergeant William Gardella pointed his gun from the passenger's side. A paper bag containing a .44 caliber Bulldog revolver of the type that was identified in ballistic texts was found next to Berkowitz in the vehicle. As described in The Son of Sam, 1981, by Lawrence E. Klausner, Detective Politico, I should say, hopefully I'm not butchering his name, remembered the big, inexplicable smile on the man's face. Now that I've got you, the detective. The detective had said to the suspect, "Who have I got?" The man in the car spoke in a soft and sweet voice, said, "You know." The detective responded by saying, "No, I don't. You tell me." The man turned his head and said, "I'm Sam." He said, "You're Sam? Sam who?" He said, "Sam, David Berkowitz." An alternate version claimed that Berkowitz's first words were reported to be, "Well, you got me. How come it took you such a long time?" Detective John Filippo was officially credited by the NYPD as the arresting officer of the Son of Sam. Upon searching apartment 7, found it in disarray with satanic graffiti along the walls. They also found diaries that he had kept since he was 21, 3 stenographers, notebooks nearly all full, wherein Berkowitz meticulously noted hundreds of arsons that he claimed to have set throughout New York City. Some sources alleged that his number might be well over 1,400. Soon after Berkowitz's arrest, the address of the building was changed from 35 Pine Street to 42 Pine Street in an attempt to end its notoriety. After the arrest, Berkowitz was briefly held in Yonkers Police Station before being transported directly to the 60th Precinct in Coney Island, where the detective's task force was located. At about 1 a.m., Mayor Abraham Beam arrived to see the suspect personally. After a brief and wordless encounter, he announced to the media, "The people of the city of New York can rest easy because of the fact that the police have in fact captured a man who they believe to be the Son of Sam." Berkowitz was interrogated for all of about 30 minutes in the early morning of August 11th in 1977 and quickly confessed to the shootings, expressing an interest in pleading guilty. During questioning, Berkowitz claimed that the neighbor's dog was one of the reasons that he killed. He stated that the dog demanded the blood of pretty young girls and said that the Sam mentioned in the first letter was his former neighbor, Sam Carr. Berkowitz claimed that Carr's black Labrador retriever, Harvey, was possessed by an ancient demon and that it issued irresistible commands that Berkowitz must, in fact, kill people for him. A few weeks after his arrest and confession, Berkowitz was permitted to communicate with the press. And in a letter to the New York Post dated September 19, 1977, Berkowitz alluded to his original story of demonic possession, but closed with a warning that has been interpreted by some investigators as an admission of criminal accomplices. He claimed that there are other sons out there. God help the world. 3 separate mental health examinations determined that Berkowitz was in fact competent enough to stand trial. Despite this, defense lawyers advised Berkowitz to enter a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, but Berkowitz refused. It appeared in court on May 8, 1978, calm as could be, pleading guilty to all the shootings. At his sentencing 2 weeks later, Berkowitz caused an uproar when he attempted to jump out of a window of the 7th-floor courtroom. After he was restrained, he repeatedly chanted, "Stacy was a whore," and shouted, "I'd kill her again. I'd kill them all again." The court ordered another psychiatric examination before the sentencing could proceed. During the evaluation, Berkowitz drew a sketch of a jailed man surrounded by numerous walls, and at the bottom he wrote, "I am not well. Not well at all." Nonetheless, to stand trial. On June 12, 1978, Berkowitz was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison for each murder, to be served consecutively. Yes, each of these life sentences was to be served back to back. He was ordered to serve time in Attica Correctional Facility and upstate New York Supermax Prison. Despite prosecutors' objections, the terms of Berkowitz's guilty plea made him eligible for parole in 25 years. Now, Berkowitz declared at a press conference during February of 1979 that his previous claims of demonic possession were a hoax. He stated in a series of meetings with a special court-appointed psychiatrist, David Abrahamson, that he had long contemplated murder to get revenge at a world that he had felt and hurt him. He claimed he felt particular anger due to his lack of success with women and thus singled out attractive young women as his victims. After his arrest, Berkowitz was initially confined to a psych ward in Kings County Hospital, where the staff reported that he seemed remarkably untroubled by his new environment. On the day after his sentencing, he was taken first to Sing Sing Prison and then to the upstate Clinton Correctional Facility for psychiatric and physical examinations. Two more months were spent at the Central New York Psychiatric Center in Marcy before his admission to Attica. Berkowitz served about a decade in Attica until he was relocated in 1990 to Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg, New York, where he remained for many years until he was again transferred to Shawangunk Correctional Facility. Berkowitz described life in Attica as a nightmare. In 1979, there was an attempt on his life in which the left side of his neck was slashed from front to back, resulting in a wound that required more than 50 stitches to close. Berkowitz, though, refused to identify his assailant, and he only claimed that he was grateful for the attack, as it brought a sense of justice, or, in his own words, claimed it was the punishment he deserved. In 1987, Berkowitz became an evangelical Christian. According to his own personal testimony, his moment of conversion occurred after reading Psalm 34, verse 6, from a Bible given to him by a fellow inmate. He says he is no longer to be referred to as the son of Sam, but the son of hope. For those of you unfamiliar with the psalm, it is a psalm that refers to time in which David pretended madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Now, before his first parole hearing in 2002, Berkowitz sent a letter to New York Governor George Pataki asking that it be canceled. He wrote, "In all honesty, I believe that I deserve to be in prison for the rest of my life. I have, with God's help, long ago come to terms with my situation, and I have accepted my punishment." Officials at the Sullivan facility duly rejected his case. Berkowitz is entitled to a parole hearing every 2 years as mandated by state law, but he has consistently refused to ask for his release, sometimes skipping the hearings altogether. In his 2016 hearing at Shawangunk, Berkowitz stated that while parole was unrealistic, he felt he had improved himself behind bars, adding, "I feel I'm no risk whatsoever." His lawyer, Mark Heller, noted that the prison staff considered Berkowitz to be a model prisoner, but commissioners once again denied parole. Now, soon after his imprisonment, it should be noted that Berkowitz invited Malachi Martin, an exorcist, to help him compose an autobiography, but the offer was not accepted. During later years, he developed his memoirs with assistance from evangelical Christians. His statements were released as an interview video, Son of Hope, during 1998, with a more extensive work released in book form entitled Son of Hope, The Prison Journals of David Berkowitz, released in 2006. Berkowitz does not receive any royalties or profit from any sales of his works and has continued to write essays on faith and repentance for Christian websites. His own official website is maintained on his behalf by a church group since he is, in fact, not allowed access to a computer. Berkowitz stays involved with prison ministry and regularly counsels troubled inmates. While in the Sullivan facility, he pursued education and graduated with honors from Sullivan Community College. During June of 2005, Berkowitz sued one of his previous lawyers for misappropriation of a large number of letters, photographs, and other personal possessions. Hugo Harmutz, a New Jersey attorney, represented Berkowitz in an earlier legal effort to prevent the National Enquirer from buying one of his letters. Harmutz then self-published his own collection of letters and memorabilia in Dear David, published in 2005, which he obtained from Berkowitz during their consultations. Berkowitz stated that he would only drop the lawsuit if the attorney signed over all the money he made to the victims' families. And in 2006, they settled out of court, with Harmutz agreeing to return the disputed items and to donate part of his book profits to the New York State Crime Victims Board. Decades after his arrest, the name Son of Sam remains widely recognized as that of a notorious serial killer. Many manifestations in popular culture have helped perpetuate this notoriety, while Berkowitz himself continues to express remorse on Christian websites. Nezia Moskowitz, who had previously not hidden her hatred of Berkowitz, wrote him a letter shortly before her own death in 2006, forgiving him for killing her daughter Stacy. There have been a number of films and books released in popular culture. He's been referenced in such popular shows as Seinfeld. He's appeared in the Spike Lee drama Summer of Sam and Dead Boys, Son of Sam. He's even been referred to by the Beastie Boys in songs and Marilyn Manson as well. The impact on popular culture, despite being a notorious murderer. Now, Berkowitz's later claims of converting from Satanism to Christianity have largely been rejected. Breslin rejected his story of satanic cult accomplices, which he had claimed to have under interrogation, stating that when they talked to David that night, he recalled everything step by step by step. Has a 1,000% recall, and that's it. He's the guy, and there's nothing else to look at, according to Breslin. Denies that Berkowitz is guilt, according to FBI profiler Johnny Douglas, lacks all credibility. But no doubt, Berkowitz will spend the remainder of his life behind bars. Before I leave you all, give you all, of course, some semblance of the kind of mind we're dealing with today. I feel it's necessary. So, before I leave you, here are some of the chilling things said by David Berkowitz. David Berkowitz once claimed, "I have several children who I'm turning into killers. Wait till they grow up." Well, this was never substantiated. David Berkowitz, in reference to the people that he had survived his attacks, had said, "I never wanted to hurt them. I only wanted to kill them." And of course, David Berkowitz said, "We must realize that we have a choice. We are responsible for our own good time. You do something you're proud of, dwell on it a little, praise yourself for it, relish the experience, and take it in." Finally, perhaps one of the most disturbing things said by David Berkowitz was that the demons wanted girls, sugar and spice, and everything nice. And this is where I leave you today, ladies and gentlemen. I do hope you've enjoyed the show. And if you're looking to find a little bit more on Mr. Berkowitz, there's a good deal of literature written on this very deranged individual. Few of these, if it strikes your fancy. You might take a look at David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, the biography. This biography is actually quoted from him directly, and is rather disturbing, but it is what it is. Of course, you might also take a look at Son of Sam, a biography written by Paul Brody. It's a biography of David Berkowitz. And Son of Sam, the life and crimes of David Berkowitz by Zed Simpson. Ladies and gentlemen, that is all the time we have today to talk about David Berkowitz. I do hope you've enjoyed our time together. I know that I have. And I trust that I'll see you all again soon. But be sure you'll hear from me next Wednesday when we talk about Attila the Hun. I've been your host, Dallas Duclo, and I will be back on Wednesday, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We talk about Attila the Hun. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. And, of course, don't forget to check out all of the other shows with Totally Driven Entertainment. Be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that Sunday we've got Straight Football Talk with Teddy the Bear, Awesome Austin Thomas, and, of course, myself. And lastly, check out Mojo Sports Show on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. Till on Sports Show, guys. Hope you enjoyed today. Catch you guys all very soon.